Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at Belmont University.
Hi, everybody. Can you hear it? Can you hear him speak?
It's working.
Oh, that, good. Kirsten, welcome to Nashville.
Thank you, Connie.
It's so lovely to have you here. Thank you all for coming today. How many people in this room have had a chance yet to read Off the Sidelines? Okay, we've got some work to do, guys. Let's get on it. It's my great honor to be here with an old college friend, Kirsten Gillibrand. Back in those days, she went as Tina Rutnick. Mm-hmm. It took me a while.
And she was Connie Womack.
And I was Connie Womack. It took a while for me to realize that my friend Tina Rutnick had become the senator in New York. But I'm extremely proud of you and inspired by you and the work that you've been doing. And this book, I think, is such a great representation of what you've done, and I know of what my own values are as a woman. So I hope everybody here will read the book. This is not Oprah, so I don't know that we're going to be giving it away today. However, I know that it will be very available at Parnassus amongst other any other book outlet, of course. So please get the book. So let's talk a little bit about, let's start with finding your own voice as a woman, and really also as a man, by the way. I think that men and women both should read this book, but why is that something that you have felt? Because as long as I've known you, you've been such a champion for that in particular, and for putting women at the forefront of their own lives and getting more women in politics and getting more women in positions of power everywhere. So tell me a little bit about your inspiration for that.
So I started the book with a story, and I said if I had a daughter, there are certain things I would tell her. I would tell her it's good to be smart, really smart, and that people may judge you on how you look or what you wear, but you should focus much more of your time on what you say and what you do. And I talk about a story where I was at work on a Sunday, and my husband took my two boys, Henry and Theo, to do a hike in Washington. And it was at the Theodore Roosevelt Island, right in the middle of Potomac River, lots of frogs and birds and beautiful trails. And Henry was about 2.5, and he's walking up this little hill, and John says, "Come on, Henry." And Henry looks up and says, "Daddy, we can do it because we're men." I, of course, get this story when I get home that night. And I'm like, are you kidding me? My son says that? How did he say that? How did he learn that? Where did that come from? But it occurred to me, you know, how many young girls are saying we can do it because we're women? And I don't think the number's enough. I don't think enough women, enough girls know that their voice is important, that their life experience is different, that their view of the world may well be different. But those differences are good and important. And if women aren't being heard in all of these places of decision making, our country's not as strong. We are much better off for that diversity of view. And I give lots of examples about how women at different decision making tables really make a difference. In the small world of politics, I remember when I was first elected in 2006, I was put on the Armed Services Committee. It was the first time that 5 women were put on that committee at one time. As new Congress members, and we were having hearings about military readiness. And military readiness typically for our male colleagues was, how many ships should we build? How many aircraft do we build? What does our complement of might look like? But the women particularly started asking very different questions. And Gabby Giffords, who was elected the same year I was, said, you know, the doctor in my base in my district told me that 70% of the men going back into combat, men and women going back into combat, aren't mentally ready. And she asked, what are you doing about readiness in terms of our personnel? And I amplified that question and said, why is the divorce rate, the domestic violence rate, and the suicide rate higher than it's ever been in the history of America? What are you doing about PTSD and traumatic brain injury? And so together, that conversation about both the equipment that is necessary to be military ready, along with the personnel who are fighting the wars, was a more complete conversation. And so the book's really a call to action. It's a little self-helpy. It's very personal, very memoir-oriented. but it's to ask women to be heard on whatever issue it is, whether it's your town council, whether it's your school board, whether maybe you just want to change the school lunch program at your kid's school, or you know what time soccer practice ends. It doesn't matter. It's your perspective, your voice, your worldview that if we don't try to be heard at a greater and more pervasive level, decisions are going to be made, and we may not like what they decide.
Yeah, I love how personal the book is. You know, and for me that was fun too, knowing you, because really you talk a lot about your life and where you come from and your family and what inspired you and who inspired you. I love the fact that your grandmother was a politician, first and foremost, because it's rare enough that you as a woman are a politician, but that your grandmother was also a politician. Can you talk a little bit about, because I know there are probably a lot of people in this audience today who are looking for mentors and inspiration and all the things that will help you find your own voice. So talk a little bit about that.
So I included a little bit of who I am and how I got here, because I always look for that when I'm reading a biography or a story about another woman. How did she get there? How did she get from A to B? And one of the things that was most important to me was having role models. And two of the greatest role models I ever had was my mother and my grandmother. Now, my grandmother was a very salty individual who found her way in politics in an era where women had very little role in politics. She was a secretary in our state legislature. She never went to college, but she realized if all the women of the legislature started speaking up and getting involved in campaigns, they could transform electoral politics, and that's what they did. They formed a club, and they are the ones who started doing the envelope stuffing, the door-to-door, and all the phone banking modern campaigns need. And over time, over 50 years, she became powerful. And frankly, you couldn't get elected in Albany if you didn't have the blessing of my grandmother and all her lady friends, because they did all the work. So I watched her feeling so confident, and I learned those life lessons that women's voices matter, that grassroots activism can make a difference, and that what you do with your time makes a difference. And so she was really important. And then my mom, you know, she was a trailblazer in her own right. She went to law school when there were only three other women in her law school class. You know, she didn't set out to take her law exams right after she gives birth to my brother, the day or two after taking her law exams while her mother has to watch her do it because she's, you know, just delivered a baby. But it's how her life turned out. And she taught me that being exactly who you are, being yourself, is really important. It's okay if you're different. And she was always different. Not only did she go to law school, but then she pursued things outside the home, like karate. She was a black belt in karate by the time she was my age. And I remember her coming home with bruises on her arms and saying, "Mom, what are you doing?" And she says, "That's really fun." So she liked it. But that gave me a life lesson that it's okay to do things differently, that you can have your own goals, that ambition is not a dirty word, that you can decide to do and be anything you want to be, but you just have to work really hard at it and not be afraid that it may not be the same as other kids in your class or other ladies in your neighborhood. You can do anything you want to.
And it doesn't have to be about politics. You
right,
know,
for sure.
That's the part that, and also speaks to me, because back when we were in college, was trying to figure out what I was going to do, and I always loved acting, but I wanted to have a bigger voice in the world. And so sort of ended up deciding, well, this theater thing is the thing that I love and I think I'm good at, and so maybe if I pursue the thing that maybe is my best talent, I will then be able to parlay that into having a voice in the world. And so I think along the lines of, not just, your book isn't just about getting into politics, it's about finding your voice and being a voice for your community and your family and
anything.
Women and men. And
well, what I love about Connie's story, I before I wrote this book, I used to do off the sidelines events all across the country where I invite people to come and talk about why their voice matters, and particularly in politics. And you know, Connie, as an actor, has always tried to use her voice to shape characters, to make them more decision makers and have voices that were important to her. So I'd love you to share just 2 minutes about being off the sidelines yourself in your own career in a way that made sense to you, because I think it's a real story of strength and courage.
Well, I do think, you know, for me, for me as an actor, I quickly realized as I studied and did all the work that you have to do, that the only way I was ever going to make, I had a hunch that the only way I was ever going to make a difference or get a job, not make a difference, forget it. It wasn't about making a difference. No. It was about getting a job. The only way I was going to be able to do that was by finding what my particular voice was. And I had lots of people that I admired. And the tendency, and I think regardless of what you do in the world or what your profession is, I think the tendency is often to think, oh, I have to do it like this and then I will be successful. And what I soon learned was, oh, I need to actually know what I have to offer that is different from everybody else. And then maybe there will be somebody who's going to be interested in that version of womanhood, you know. So, but, you know, Friday Night Lights, the show that I did a few years ago, was a great example because, you know, I was very sure that I had made an enormous mistake when I agreed to do the TV show Friday Night Lights. I had already done the movie, and I think I ended up with about 3 lines total in the movie. Everything else was on the kind of, it's a movie about football. And my part was not very big. And so I thought for sure I was making a mistake when I decided to do the TV show, but the creator of the show really wanted to give the women in that community that we hadn't been able to do in the film, he wanted to give them a voice because the show was really about a community. And so we worked really hard to do that and to find, you know, to let the women on the show, and particularly the character that I played, have a voice, and have a voice in the world of football, which is obviously a very male-dominated world. And I think for me, that's just been, and I think for a lot of the audience, it was a great example of how we can always have a voice, even when it sounds like it doesn't seem like it's going to make a difference, or it doesn't seem as if it's going to be important.
And what I really liked the way how Connie created this character for Tammy Taylor is she just kept wanting to give her a stronger voice. Larger decision-making roles, pushing back on scripts to say, no, that's not how women actually act. That's not what they're thinking. That's not what they're doing. And I loved that because she owned that character to say, this is going to be a voice for women who are in this kind of community about things they would struggle with, things they would demand, things that they would stand up for. And I think that's something we can all do in our lives. And that's what the book's about. The book is really about, where in your life do you have an opinion that's not being shared? And it can be anywhere. It could be within your family. It could be within your community. It could be on any level. And what I see is the absence of women's voices resulting in worse outcomes. And I see it in my life because I'm in politics. We only have 20 women senators in the Senate out of 100. And we only have 18% in the House of Representatives. And the way that distorts things from what I see is Congress has spent 4 years, 2 whole congressional cycles, debating whether women should have access to affordable contraception. Now, 98% of America's women take contraception during their lifetimes, 30% not even for contraception, but for other medical reasons. And they're wasting all of this time, the national debate on whether it should be affordable. If Congress was 51% women, I guarantee you we wouldn't spend a minute on it. It would be a foregone conclusion. What the absence of women's voices, you know, what the result of it is, it means decisions aren't being made as comprehensively as they should be. All that time we could have been spent on the economy or national security or 100 other issues that we care so deeply about. And it's because of the absence of our voices that the debate's not reflective. And I think that's true across the board when you look at corporate America. You know, women are only 3% of the CEOs, they're only 16% of board members. But when a woman is on these boards, they show higher returns on investment, higher returns on equity. There's a statistic that's funny that you have to think through to fully understand it, but even if one woman is on a corporate board, that company is 40% less likely to have to restate their earnings. What that means is her presence alone makes them keep the ship going in the right direction. So I just find that I know it's true, and I see it in my regular mom life too. You know, we've got coaches of soccer teams who want the kids to play till 8:45. I'm like, are you kidding me? My kid has to be in bed by 8:30. He's not going to be on the field. You know, so we push back. And we have to push back because if we are heard in these circles and these decision-making tables, I think outcomes are better.
And do you think, you know, I'd love to hear from you some of the obstacles because I think sometimes it feels overwhelming. You know, it does feel like such an uphill climb to be able to have a voice, or as you say, that it's such a small percentage of women in the Senate and in the House. So it feels a little like, oh, you just throw up your hands. And I know that you probably, in that environment, probably feel sometimes a little bit like nobody's going to listen to me. And
yes,
yet you've made so much headway. So can you speak a little bit about some of the obstacles and some of the ways that you've overcome those?
So I'm going to give one obstacle story and then one overcome story, because they're very different. So my biggest obstacle was early on in my career when I didn't know how to get from A to B. I have a whole chapter called From A to B with Detours, because I wanted to do public service, but I didn't know how to get there. And it was Hillary Clinton, when she went to China and gave her famous speech, Women's Rights Are Human Rights and Human Rights Are Women's Rights. And it woke me up, Connie, because of our China experience. I didn't even know about the conference. It was like a Women's of the World conference, huge, big deal. Didn't even know about it, wasn't invited. But Connie and I had learned Mandarin. We had studied in Beijing, where this conference was taking place, and I knew nothing about it. And so I was really kicking myself because I wasn't involved. And I realized the only way I would have been invited to this conference is if I was involved in politics. And so that's what made me realize, as an adult, I need to get involved in politics. And so I joined a women's group because somebody's mom suggested I do it. And I remember going to the first event, and Hillary Clinton was actually the speaker. She looks out into the audience, and it's about 100 women, and I'm the youngest woman by at least 10 or 20 years. And she says, decisions are being made every day in Washington, and if you're not part of those decisions and you don't like them, you have no one to blame but yourself. And I'm thinking, oh my God, she's right. I have no one to blame but myself. And she's talking to me. She's talking to me. And so I'm thinking, I gotta get involved in politics. And so I'm in a big fancy law firm in New York City working endless hours. And I thought, how do I get involved? So the first thing young lawyers often do is we try to do a government service type job. So I applied to the U.S. Attorney's Office thinking, I'll be a prosecutor. I did not get that job. So then I thought, well, I'll apply to the charitable world. I'll apply to the Ford Foundation, or the Carnegie Corporation, or Rockefeller Foundation. I didn't even get a response. I never heard back from any of them. And then Hillary decides to run for Senate, and I think, oh, this is my big chance. I'm going to work on her campaign. But I had bills to pay, and I couldn't get a paid position, so I didn't get to work on her campaign. And it wasn't until I went to an event, and this is maybe 2 years of trying, where the speaker was Andrew Cuomo, who was the secretary of HUD at the time. And his speech is actually about public service and why it's so important to do public service and be a Democrat. And so I'm so frustrated by this point, I kind of walk up to him afterwards and say, well, Mr. Secretary, I really think politics is an insider's game, and I don't know how to get from A to B. And so Andrew, if you know anything about Andrew, he's very provocative. So he's like, well, what do you do? I said, I'm a senior associate at Davis Polk. He said, well, would you move to Washington? Now, I was a young single girl in New York City. I had no interest in moving to Washington. But of course I said, of course I'll move to Washington. And so I go down. A few days later, I get called, I get the interview, I get the job, and I go home that night, and I had a boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband, Jonathan. And I think, like all things in life, it is so important to have a partner who believes in you and encourages you, and Jonathan has always been that guy for me. So he just says, Kirsten, since I've known you, all you've ever wanted to do is public service. Take the job. Davis Polk doesn't need you. I will see you on weekends. And so 2 weeks later, I'm in D.C. starting my new job. And it was my foot in the door that I needed. I just had to figure out how to start, and that's all I needed. Once I did it, I loved it so much, I decided then and there I'm going to run for office someday. And they lost that election. It was Bush v. Gore, so there were no more appointed positions in D.C. Went back to New York, switched firms, eventually moved upstate where I'm from, and ran for office there about 6 years later. But that was my big obstacle. The overcoming is interesting. My biggest challenge when I first got elected was a tough campaign, red, red, red district, won anyway, got reelected, was eventually appointed to the Senate, which was a huge opportunity. But when I was appointed to the Senate, no one thought I could succeed. I heard that the press pool was taking bets on the day I was appointed about how many months I would last. Of course, I showed them that they were wrong, but what I realized is I had some things to learn, and one of the things I didn't know is how to convince people to support things I cared about. And I asked for advice, which is what women often do well, and I asked Mary Landrieu, how did you convince people to vote to support victims of Hurricane Katrina? How did you make that a national issue? And she gave me very good advice. She said, Kirsten, no one is going to care about the 9/11 first responders, which was the bill I was trying to pass. No one is going to care about the 9/11 first responders if you don't show why you care. And I thought, huh, I hadn't done that at all. And so I started meeting with the first responders and really getting to know them personally, what was going on in their lives and how they were dying of these horrible toxins because they breathed in, dying of horrible diseases like cancers because of all the toxins they breathed in. And then when they were at Ground Zero doing all the cleanup and first looking for survivors. And so I began to tell their stories. And as I told their stories, they were so heartbreaking. I was doing one Senate floor speech where I started to cry. And I was like, oh my God, this is the worst thing ever. Like, I'm going to be so made fun of because you don't cry on the Senate floor. But I was so upset because I was reading a letter that a man had written to his wife when he was dying. And he had two young kids like I did. And I couldn't get over how horrible it must be to be 40-something and knowing you're dying and not being able to do a thing about it. And so, but it mattered because right after that speech, somebody who had worked in the Senate for a long time came up to me and said, I've been here a long time. I've never heard a speech like that. He said, thank you. So that show of emotion, that passion, that ability to really take in someone's pain and then explain it to others really is the lesson I learned, that if you're ever going to be a good public servant or ever be an advocate for whomever or whatever issue, you have to believe in it and you have to feel it as if it's your own. And that was the most important lesson I ever learned about how to really be a public servant.
And that's also a way that women can contribute to that, to the that political environment, because, you know, I think more women making that okay will then let that be okay for all the politicians.
Yeah, and just feeling things more deeply, like not being so superficial about, you know, what we're doing or what the cause is. But you know in your own lives, when you care about something different, if you care about something deeply, you will get very exercised about it. And that is good. That emotion, that passion, that determination is actually really effective. And I think women are often very good at feeling that emotion deeply, and it makes us really strong advocates.
But does it sometimes feel dangerous?
I was very insecure. I thought I was in trouble. I thought I just blew it. I thought, oh, my credibility's down the drain. But that's not the case. And what I've realized and been able to embrace since is it's your commitment. It's that you believe in it as much as if it happened to you. And that is what is so important, that, you know, you have to own what you are about and what you care about and then fight with all your might. And that's how to be a strong advocate. And you know, for particular women, we're often very good at that. We're often very good empathizers. We're often very good at being able to feel an issue and understand it and put ourselves in someone else's shoes. And that ability to empathize is powerful. And we should realize that about ourselves.
That's right. So I think that when I read your book, I finished it and I thought, I want boys and girls and women and men to read this, you know. And I think that's always something that we have to overcome when we're talking about getting more women out there, having more women's voices heard, is that it sounds to me like it's somehow exclusive of men. And I always try to find ways to
include them.
To include them and to not make it feel as if we're talking about, you know, female empowerment, that somehow means that we want to disempower men, that in fact we will all be more powerful if women have
right. It's the combination that's so strong.
So can you speak to that a little
sure.
bit?
Sure. And, you know, Connie has a son. I have two sons. So we are mothers of sons. And one of the lessons that I certainly want to teach my boys is that girls may well be different from you, but that's a good difference. And you should appreciate that about them and enjoy their differences. But, you know, I think these issues are relevant to all men. And, you know, one of the challenges we have are institutional biases. And we see it in this big scandal with the NFL. We see it with sexual assault in the military. We see it with sexual assault on college campus. And the dynamic that we are seeing over and over again is that institutions are protecting their favored. So whether it's the favored athlete or whether it's the favored soldier or whether it's the favored student, there's an institutional bias that is protecting the status quo. And in that process, almost inevitably, is voices aren't being heard. And it's not always just female voices. Victims of sexual assault are often male, and in the military, more victims are male than female, even though it's a higher percentage of women because there's less women in the military. But these voices need to be heard, and they need to be heard and valued. And really what I'm finding in these debates about sexual assault is that women aren't being valued. What's happened to that woman isn't important enough to hold the perpetrator accountable. And so whether you are in the military setting or on a college campus setting or with this recent NFL scandal, we see it over and over again. And what will make the difference is male voices, male leaders, male decision makers saying, I am going to also fight against the status quo. I am going to make sure all voices are heard, that women are valued, and that this kind of violence is unacceptable. It is a serious crime and needs to be treated as a serious crime. And so that's going to take effort by everyone.
But how do you think, and you may not have an answer to this, but this is an important question, I think, which is how do you think that you get men to feel that that is as important, that's an issue as important as it is to women?
Well, interestingly, it is a challenge, but I've had a lot of men come to my events about this book and say, please write it to my daughters, please write it to my wife. Men are often married, and they may well have daughters. And so even if they can't see...
And they all have mothers.
And they all have mothers. You don't get here without a mother. It's all true. And so they have someone in their lives that they love deeply. And so even though they may not be able to imagine being victimized or brutalized or truly understanding what that disempowerment feels like, they may know what it would feel like to have that happen to their daughter. They may be able to imagine it happening to their wives, and that's relevant, and that's important. And so they should care as much as women, in terms of our voice being heard, that their voices are heard too, because they believe in their daughters, they believe in their wives and mothers, and they know that their voices are important. They'll also know in their own lives how important their mothers' voices were to them. And so if they just can remember that and say, let's be more respectful, let's be more inclusive, and, yeah. and strive for it, because, you know, it doesn't happen alone that only 3% of CEOs in America are women. It doesn't happen just because women aren't trying for those jobs. It is because of a lot of dynamics, and we can all take responsibility for it.
And I think that, you know, again, it doesn't have to be about politics. You know, I think that it starts in your school, it starts in your community, and if we create that as a baseline for women and for men, for boys and girls, we can change the culture, and we can change the fabric of the culture. Do you think that that's something that you can see, even in the time that you've been in the Senate, you can see any shift in that direction?
Yes. So I've seen it really quite boldly in the Armed Services Committee, because this last 2 years we've really focused on this issue of sexual assault in the military. And really the presence of 7 women on that committee was a shift. Every single woman in the Senate, all 20 of them, helped write a piece of legislation about how to end sexual violence in the military. And 17 out of 21 agreed on the most aggressive means, which was taking the decision-making out of the chain of command for all serious crimes. And I think that the fact that so many women were willing to put their muster behind this and so willing to push really hard, there was no way we weren't going to address it. It was going to be on the agenda, and we were going to make sure we keep it on the agenda. I'm also trying to focus our interest on issues that affect the whole country in terms of women's economic empowerment, which is really important. We have had this issue of workplace policies that are truly stuck in the Mad Men era. They are designed for when, typically, moms stayed at home and dads went to work. But that is not the face of the workplace today. Today, 8 out of 10 moms are working. 4 out of 10 moms are primary or sole breadwinners. And so if you don't have workplace policies that reflect that fact, you're going to lose women, or they are going to be constantly and chronically pulled down to lower wage jobs because there's no accommodation for their needs. Women are often the primary caregivers. They're often the ones who will not only look after children when they're born, but deal with family emergencies throughout the lifetime of their children, but also when their parents age. If your mother is gravely ill and is dying of cancer, you're going to be by her side. There's going to be certain changes you will make. So whether it's you ramp off your career completely, whether you work less hours, whether you change jobs, or if you have to miss work and get fired, you'll get another low-wage job. And it's particularly affecting the low-wage workers. 2/3 of minimum wage earners are women, and that's because of this chronic cycle. So let's just say you're a low-wage worker and you had a baby, and your caregiver's sick and you have to go take care of your child. Well, if you miss work, you will probably either be fired or certainly not promoted. And so you're going to be constantly pulled down to the next low-wage job. So, and if you are a professional, ask any woman who's ramped off for a few years to look after children. When she ramps back on, she does not get the same salary. She does not get the same title. She's working in less senior positions than where she left, and she almost inevitably doesn't regain her seniority because it's just this massive impediment placed into her career. And what that creates, in my opinion, is a drag on the economy. Because if half your workforce, or close to half your workforce, isn't earning their full potential and isn't at their full management level of ability, you're not shooting on all cylinders. You're not creating the most economic, strongest economic engine. And women are graduating more than half the college degrees and more than half of the advanced degrees. So we have a lot of talent, a lot of education, a lot of opportunity that's being wasted. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge problem. So I'm trying to now create this as an issue to drive enormous discussion behind. And I think as women and women in every state begin to think about why don't we have equal pay in this country, they'll begin to say, this issue matters to my family too.
Yeah, and that makes me think about, in your book, you talk about, and I'm paraphrasing, but you talk about the concept of having it all, you know, mm-hmm. women having it all, and that's sort of insulting, like it implies
it's somehow, really insulting.
That we're somehow being greedy
yes.
about that.
So think about the phrase having it all. What are we having? Are we having a vacation? Are we having a second slice of pie? What are we having?
Well, whatever it is, we're being real piggish about it.
Yeah, we're very piggish about it because we're having something. And then when you say having it all, the all is terrible too because it's implying that women who aren't working are somehow having a life that's less than full, which is not true. So it's a terrible frame for a debate that is a serious one. And I say we should be talking and debating about how women are doing it all and whether we're supporting them. Because women are working, whether it's inside the home or outside the home, they are working all the time. They are raising their kids, feeding their kids, providing for their kids, and they need support. So something as simple as universal pre-K or affordable daycare would go a very long way to helping women manage all their responsibilities. Equal pay is as obvious as anything. And there's this notion of paid leave. We are the only industrialized country in the world that doesn't have it. Afghanistan and Pakistan, who don't even want to educate their daughters, have paid leave. So for all those family times, whether it's the new kid, the new baby, or whether it's the child gets hit by a car, isn't in a wheelchair for 5 months, or whether it's the aging parent who really needs 24/7 care, there's no flexibility that this country supports to make sure those women stay in the workplace where they want to be.
And you said also, too, that when you first went into office, they told you that you really, it was up to you to be protective of your family.
Yes.
You know, and that's another big issue. I like to think that it's becoming a bigger issue for men and women alike,
yeah.
the idea of juggling everything, juggling family, juggling the job. But what has been your experience with that? Because...
Well, this was a very scary conversation. So the new congresspeople in an auditorium not dissimilar to this, we're all sitting there, and this very ancient congressman comes up and says, I have some stories to tell you. And he says, and he's giving us advice. And I'm assuming he's going to tell us about our budgets and where the bathroom is and whatever. But no, that's not what he talked about. He said, you know, most members of Congress are divorced. Most members of Congress, their children either don't talk to them or hate them. And you are the only person who can prevent that from happening. And the way you do that is you have to put your family first. So when your 22-year-old scheduler comes to you and books every minute of your day and every minute of your evening and every minute of your weekend, you're the one who's going to have to say no. And I was sweating. I was like, oh my God, this is going to be so hard. What's going to happen to me? And so I've decided, and frankly, every parent does this, anybody who has family responsibilities, you have to make decisions about what's going to make sense for you. And some jobs allow zero flexibility. You know, the woman who's going to clean this auditorium tomorrow, she probably is given certain hours, and those are her hours. She doesn't get to change them. The woman who's double shifts at the emergency room does not get to change her hours. My job is far more flexible. I can cancel a meeting if I need to, if I have a sick child and I have to run to school and get him. I can bring my child to work if I need to. I can limit meetings before 9 a.m. so I can bring my kids to school and make their lunches and get them breakfast and find the soccer kit and get out the door on time like every other parent. I can do that because I have flexibility. But I think for all of us, we as women and we as parents, because I think men are now beginning to focus themselves on what do I want my life to look like? And pushing back, if we all demand a certain level of flexibility that makes sense for our families and our lives, workplace policies eventually will respond. The ones that have responded the most are in the highest paid professional areas. The low-wage worker has nothing. She may not have a sick day. She may not have a vacation day. I have a young woman who works for me who, when she was having her child, her child's about 10 now, she was in a low-wage job. She was a waitress, and she had no sick days, no vacation days. So she figured out that when I have this baby, I'm going to have to quit because I'll be fired the second I don't show up to work the next day. So she, in order to have any kind of maternity leave, she had to quit, find another low-paying job that she could start in a couple of months. She had to go on Medicaid so she'd have her health care covered. She used publicly available services at Planned Parenthood to get the prenatal care she needed. But she had to figure this out. Now, that's a tough place that a lot of young moms are in, and that's wrong. We should have much better and more supportive policies so that she'd have the flexibility to be home with her child and not have to lose her job or not be able to pay her rent.
So I kind of want to hear from our audience a little bit.
Yeah, open it up.
Are we equipped for that?
Just stand up and belt it out.
We're in a concert hall after all.
Any Start questions?
Yes, they are.
The lady in brown. Right.
Network. And I just wonder if women are sometimes less willing to support each other and band together to help women as a group than men sometimes.
So I think women are better at networking than men in terms of our skill sets. You know, just imagine you come to a new town. You know you're going to call your six girlfriends and say, what's the best place to get my hair cut? What's the best place to do my groceries? Who's the best pediatrician? You're going to get every bit of detail and information you're going to need very quickly because you're very good at that. But I think there's a lot of institutions that are built up around the allowance of men to network. So whether it's the golf club, whether it's the locker room, whether, you know, all these institutions that create space for men to have private time to network were often closed to women. You know, most of those clubs were. But women are beginning to push back, and women in the business world are beginning to create lots of networks. Even Sheryl Sandberg said, have a lean-in circle, you know, create your own world. And I just read another book called The Stiletto Network, and it was all about how these networks of women are forming in different industry groups to help support one another. And we thrive in those groups. So yes, we may in a given part of our life feel isolated because we don't have that. But that's why you have a book club. That's why you join the PTA. It's why you can find yourself. But once you do, women thrive in those networks. We can be so supportive of one another. And I share lots of stories, just one funny story. One of my colleagues in the Senate was up for re-election, and she was working so hard. I mean, I just watched her, you know, just get back to her state every weekend, meeting with constituents, working. And she just started losing so much weight. And, she, you know, it was 10 pounds, and it was 20 pounds. I think it was maybe even 30 pounds. All her suits were falling off her, and I knew she didn't have a minute to herself. So I went out, I bought her a suit, and I took her into the cloakroom. I said, this is for you, just because I think you need it. And it was a cute little size 6 suit. I think she probably went down a few sizes. And the day she put it on, it was for her first debate with her opponent, and I get a little text from her saying, I just put on my new suit, it looks great, I'm going to go out and beat this guy. And it was like that little lift that I felt she needed so things that her clothes would fit properly. And it was a small thing, but that's the kind of thing girlfriends do. And I have actually a whole chapter about the importance of girlfriends because, you know, there's that moment when you're with your girlfriend and you have a glass of wine and you take your shoes off when you're like, oh, finally, I can complain and no one's going to yell at me. Like you can actually share what's on your mind and be very direct because we all know, we've all had that day. We all know that moment when we feel defeated or deflated and just need someone to say, yeah, but you're awesome, and don't worry about it, and he was a jerk anyway, and, you know, whatever it is at that moment. And so I think we're particularly well designed for getting support from one another, and I would suggest if anyone's having a bad time wherever they are, to reach out to your girlfriends. Create a circle that you can see. Create a mom's night out. Create a girl's night out. Whatever it is, it makes such a difference. In fact, one more story. At my kid's school, I always volunteer to be in charge of the mom's night out because I know that if I'm in charge of it, I will get it scheduled and it will happen because I need it more than any of them. So So I recommend it. I think that's the best way to find that comfort that you need. In the back, right there. Yep. The question is, can you speak to the Fair Pay Act and why can't we get it done? I mean, it's crazy town. But the reason is it's unfortunately, it's seen as a political issue, but it shouldn't be. And one of the reasons why I wrote this book is I want women to know all around the country that their voice about these equity issues and these economic issues are really important. Because no member of Congress should be voting against fair pay. It's absurd. We should be earning a dollar on the dollar for the same work as men. And today, women are getting 78 cents on the dollar. And for most young women, I bet you didn't know that. I bet that most of your friends didn't know that if you were doing the same job, you'd be actually being paid less. But that is the statistics, and that's the reality. And if you're a woman of color, you're getting even less. Women of color, 68 cents on the dollar for African American and 58 cents on the dollar for Latina. I mean, that's terrible. And so we have to push back on that, and as women who live in states that are represented by someone who may not support equal pay, that's the kind of issue we should continually raise to them. You know, write the letter to the editor. Why is Congressman so-and-so not supporting equal pay? I work hard every day. I need to get fair pay, and my family needs me to get fair pay. That is an issue we should all embrace, and I think our voice, if we are heard on it, could actually shift the landscape.
Yeah, because I think especially younger women assume that this isn't even an issue.
Totally.
So we need to make it known that it is still an issue. You know,
right.
We've come so far, and yet the idea that that is just the fundamental.
And you know,
standard.
Connie and I were, you know, she's at least a decade younger than me, but when we went to college together, we were told, as everyone in our generation was told, there's nothing you can't do. We were the first generation where we really had educational parity. Now, Dartmouth is a little more male-dominated than the average school, but even when we were there, it was close to 45-55. It was almost 50-50. But we have educational parity. Again, we're doing better than our male colleagues in terms of graduating college and graduating advanced degrees. So most young women, when they graduate, their world has never shown a gender bias to them. It's just not a reality yet. But wait till they're 10 years in. It's when you're having your kids. It's when you're having crises at home. It's when there's no support for you. It's when you get married and you're part of the statistic that women are still doing 70% of all housework and childcare. It's when all those things begin to happen. It's when you're up for partner and for some reason all the men make it and all the women don't. And you're like, what? That you begin to say, wow, maybe there are some challenges that I wasn't aware of. That's what happened to me. I did not think there were any gender-based challenges. I thought my mom and my grandma solved that problem. They have won the debate. But really, if you look at this Congress, we're still fighting the battles that my grandmother and my mother won. So it's really frustrating because you wonder, where's the women's movement? Is it dead? Is it on life support? And I really question, you know, because we all assumed those battles were over, mm-hmm. but apparently they're not.
Well, even in my business, you know, men absolutely, you know, the male lead of a movie is traditionally going to get paid more than the female lead of a movie where she's the same kind of lead. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's the same kind of thing. And you can have hear all kinds of arguments, oh, well, that's because, you know, he's driving the movie, he'll bring more to the box office. You know, there are all these arguments for it, but the bottom line is it makes no sense.
Right.
And actually, in this day and age, a lot of women are going to the movies now, and women are going to the movies to see movies. And so I think, you know, in my world, that's another thing where I want to, you have to work really hard. You have to demand, you know, you have to
demand.
While I'm negotiating a deal for a job, I'm gonna push hard on that.
And it's good that you do, Connie, because a lot of women don't. You know, when women negotiate their first salaries, only 7% of women typically will negotiate their first salaries, where 57% of men do. So on that first day, our male colleagues are saying, I'm worth a lot more than that. I gotta get my salary. Where the women they don't want to rock the boat. It's their first day. They want to get along. They want to be welcoming. They want to be a team player, which are all great instincts. But it often means we don't get our fair share because we're not doing the push. And so it's hard. And so you need, one of the reasons why you have to elevate it to a legal issue and writing a law is it's still illegal to compare what your salaries are. You get fired. If you're at a company and somebody does the exact same job as you and you say, hey, Joe, how much do you make? You could get fired. That's really unacceptable. So we are working now to make that as the Fair Pay Act that she mentioned, to say, no, you actually can compare your salaries and you can't be fired for that, and give companies incentives to actually look hard. Look at your employees. Test it. Are the women making the same as the men? Really look at it. Because we don't recognize our own biases sometimes. But there's a funny study that I looked at once that said, men make more than women in every industry except one. Think about which one it might be. It's not nursing. Nope. It's not teaching. Nope. Psychotherapy. Female therapists make more. We listen better. It's the only one. It's the only one. So it's hard.
So women make the majority of everyday household decisions around what we spend. Mm-hmm. We make the most charitable decisions. We're often the ones writing those checks to charities. How do we translate that purchasing power into political power? And how do we break down those perhaps those male-dominated institutions that you shared with that purchasing power?
Mm-hmm. I love that question.
I know,
because I have been trying to pitch this idea to some of the .com brilliant people. So the question is, so women make most of the purchases in the household. We have almost all the buying power in our own households. Women make most of the decisions about charitable giving as well. And there are massive statistics that when you hear them, you're like, wow, we really, it's like huge numbers of the majority, vast majority of purchasing power rests with women and their households. And so her question is, how do we translate that into more overt power, into more decision-making power, more broadly? And so I love the question, because I haven't been able to figure out how do I translate A to B. But one, there's three things I've come up with so far. One is to have women own political decisions. Because, for example, if we get more involved in campaigns, not only just voting is the most important, encouraging your whole circle of loved ones and colleagues and friends to also vote, to make that an issue. Women rarely talk about religion or politics. It's not very polite in some circles. So we avoid it. But I would say, don't avoid it anymore. Own your politics and make sure everyone in your world votes, and votes consistent with their values, and you should talk that through with them. To say, well, did you know that guy that you think is so great did X, Y, and Z and believes in A, B, and C, and really inform the debate. So translate it to vote, but also translate your giving. Women give less and give smaller amounts. And so translate that into the campaigns that you believe in. Send the $5. Send the $5 every month. Send the $10. If you're a woman of means, send $1,000, whatever it might be. Use your purchasing power as part of your voice for policy and values that you stand for and how it's translated to leaders. Now, in terms of businesses, what I was trying to pitch to my .com friends is I wanted to have an app where, is it a women-friendly business? And so if you could convince one of these really smart inventors to say, in every business in my 1 mile radius, tell me the women-friendly businesses, and then create your measurables. You know, is it women-owned? Do they have women on their corporate board? Do they sell products that, whatever your measurable is that makes it women-friendly, have it designated such. So you can choose between the two coffee shops. Well, this one has a lot of women and actually has paid sick days. This one doesn't. I'm going to the paid sick days one. And begin to translate our values that are adopted or not adopted by corporate America into our decisions. So I pitched that to a couple of entrepreneurs, and one of them liked it, but it's not been done yet. So I want that to happen so that I can have that app on my phone, and then any other woman who has a set of values she cares about it can have it on her phone too, and then we decide which business we're going to support. Now, there's a woman that I met the other day who just created a certification called EDGE Certification, and she will certify your company if it's family female friendly. So meaning, do you have paid leave? Do you have sick days? Do you have women in your executive suite? Do you have women on your board? And she will rate them, just like LEEDs, LEED, certified for environmental issues. She's now created EDGE certification. Now, it's a new company. It's only been up and running for maybe a year or two. But she has that vision. So those are the kinds of things we could build and create that, to the extent we have the ability to figure out how to do that, I think that would be valuable. And have just, have a, if we could have some designation, family friendly or not. And I would love politicians to be able to us to say, family friendly or not, are they going to support these policies? And for my supporters, I have a checklist of 5 things. I said, the next time somebody comes in and asks you for money, ask them if they're going to support equal pay. Ask them if they're going to support paid leave. Ask them if they believe in affordable daycare. Ask them if they believe in universal pre-K. And if they say no, close your checkbook. Because those issues matter to us, you know, and to put our issues where our money is. And if we could translate it in a broader way, that would be unbelievably powerful. You can pick, yeah. Go ahead. Well, I am definitely supporting Hillary Clinton in 2016, and I think she will win. And I think having a female president will matter. I think her worldview is different, and I think those differences are good. I think she will put paid leave on the national agenda and really fight hard for it, and I think that will matter. Along with all the other things we talked about today. So I don't know if things are changing. I think that when women do run, they win. Our women candidates are really strong. They are often seen as more authentic. They're often seen as more honest. They're often seen as more relatable. So the voters in North Dakota, even though it's a red state, they look at Heidi Heitkamp and say, she's just like me. I trust her with decisions because I think she'd represent my family better. So she gets voted in a red state. We have a lot of candidates that are running in red states this cycle. Michelle Nunn's running in Georgia. It's a long shot, but I think she can actually win. I think it's possible. So I just encourage these women to run, because when they do run, they win. And we need more people. But women look at politics and they often say, it's gross, it's broken, it's dysfunctional, it's nasty. I'm not going to put my family through that. There's no way. But if you tell that woman, well, you're the only one who cares about the environment and global climate change, and if you don't stand up for that, no one's really going to fight for it, she might say, oh, really? I was like, yeah, you're the only one, because the other guys who want to run, that's not important to them, or equal pay is not important, whatever it might be. And when she knows her voice is different and unique, and that she's the only one who could actually make the difference and win, she will run. And so convincing, I call it the Rosie the Riveter of our generation. If you remember Rosie in World War II, she had her sleeves rolled up, the slogan was, we can do it. And it was a request for women to enter the workforce during World War II, because a lot of the war industries needed people, because a lot of men were fighting. And 6 million women responded to that ad, because they knew, number one, they were needed, and they were told they could do it. I want the same call to action in politics to tell women, number one, they are needed, and number two, they can do it. And with that assurance, I want 6 million women voting who are voting today, or at least holding these elected leaders accountable. That would be good for America. Yes. Yeah. No, you know, and you have to realize Washington's very cynical. So they'll just say, oh, it was just a political vote, you know, it's not important. But those are the votes that really are important, because they're about us and they're about our families and our communities. And I think if we can make more of these issues electoral issues, meaning this is what we're deciding when we're deciding who should be our member of Congress or our mayor or our town council member, that we really define our priorities clearly and really know what candidates feel. I hope in the next presidential debate, that every candidate's asked, are you going to support paid leave? It should be on the national agenda. It's absurd we're the only industrialized country that doesn't have it. I want, are you supportive of equal pay on the national debate questions? I want every candidate who's running for president to be asked those questions. And that's something we can deliver. You know, because if we keep driving this conversation and having it with our local letters to the editor, or having it, you know, in our local call-in radio programs, it resonates. And the more people that begin to say, yeah, this question has to be asked, it's going to be asked. Our voices really can transcend the cynicism, and that's what we have to do. Because that's what our democracy is about. The only way our government works is when regular people stand up and demand something different. And that's, I think, what all of us can do as women, as people, and as members of this community.
And regular people is all of us. Regardless of what you do, whether you're a senator or an actress, it's all of us. And that's what's inspiring about your book.
Well, thank you, Connie.
So go get the book off the sidelines. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for coming.